This week on Making Contact.
Nobody likes to leave their home.
When you finance and train a gang of uniformed butchers and they begin wholesale killing, wiping out whole villages, the people don't emigrate. They flee.
It's not just jobs and prosperity that draw immigrants to the United States. Many Latin Americans were brought here by dangerous or deadly conditions, which the U.S. often helps create. On this edition, part two of Harvest of Empire, a documentary film written and narrated by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez. Today, in excerpts from the film, Gonzalez traces the history of Nicaraguan and Salvadoran migration to the United States. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
All the people of this hemisphere are entitled to a decent way of life, and to transform that principle into the reality of economic advance and social justice on which political equality must be based. Those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable.
Power sometimes is very disagreeable when you have to make very painful decisions.
Former Nicaraguan President Anastasio Tajito Somoza.
You see, to run a country like ours, it has to hurt you a great deal because you have to make decisions which sometimes are not agreeable.
Nicaragua, like many of the Caribbean basin countries, suffered from the same family rule. First with Anastasio Somoza and then with his two sons succeeding him. They were perhaps as brutal, if not quite at the same level as the Trujillo,
but they also wanted to run the country to meet their own needs and the needs of those immediately around them.
Even Roosevelt said of Somoza, you know, he might be an SOB, but he's our SOB.
Sister Pat Murray, former missionary in Central America.
I think when I went to Latin America, I was very naive. I was going down to do, you know, really good work, to talk about God. And the more I was there, the more I all of a sudden found myself going in the same circle that people are, the same, you know, you go from poverty to poverty, to more poverty. And, you know, all of a sudden you say, now, wait a second, there's something the matter with this whole system. Viva la revolución popular sandinista! Esa gente
que está ahí por donde Juan Rodríguez, que se metan! To understand where Nicaragua is heading, you have to know where it has come from. The young rebels who took to the streets in insurrection were battling a family that had ruled Nicaragua for almost 50 years, the Somozas, a family installed in power by the U.S. government following 20 years of occupation of Nicaragua by the U.S. Marines. Though their countrymen were desperately poor, the Somoza family amassed a huge personal fortune.
General, I've been told that your wealth is in the neighborhood of $500 million.
Well, that's what the people who advise me say that. But I think we're around $100 million.
You own the national airline?
Yes.
You own the national shipping line?
Yes, I founded that.
Including your own port, Port Somoza?
Also, we founded that.
You own the Mercedes-Benz dealership for the country?
Yes, I got that when I was a major in the Army.
You own the leading television station?
Yes.
Radio station. You own huge financial interests in banks and insurance companies? And
yes, we could go on and on.
And then the Somozas made the fatal mistake of killing the national hero, Pedro Joaquin Chamorro, this crusading journalist.
Ambassador Robert White.
After they killed Pedro Joaquin Chamorro, the banks and businesses closed their doors and went on strike. And so the economy of Nicaragua fell to a trickle.
Such was the widespread revulsion toward the Somoza family that when their regime was finally toppled in July of 1979, the victorious revolutionaries were a broad-based coalition of Nicaraguan society,
the church, big business, students, city dwellers, farmers.
Peoples more numerous and more politically aware are craving and now demanding their place in the sun, not just for the benefit of their own physical condition, but for basic human rights.
Jimmy Carter, unlike many of the previous presidents and those who would come after, was more willing to accept sort of a diversity of political views around the world, including to accept the Sandinistas as the legitimate government of Nicaragua.
The wonderful thing was those first few years after the revolution, everybody was working together. It was a real time of hope, and it was a moment that nobody can take from those people. But unfortunately, the children didn't live it.
Many of those who fought alongside the Sandinistas saw their revolution betrayed. They were denied power in the new government. Some were imprisoned, others exiled. Thousands who fought with the Sandinistas have taken up arms against them and are now called the Contras. They are freedom fighters.
The Contras were mostly former National Guardsmen. They would come in and just arrest anybody who was young, take them, torture them. If they were lucky, they would let go. Mothers would say to their kids, get out of the country. I don't want you getting caught up in this. You know, that's just what the ambience was in the country at that time. And then when you had the Contra attacking, and then the government wanting to recruit the sons to go and fight the Contra, then it was really get these kids out of here.
Good evening. When President Reagan and Attorney General Edwin Meese appeared in the White House briefing room on short notice today, no one was prepared for their surprising announcements that money from the controversial Iran arms deal was secretly funneled to the Contra rebels fighting the Sandinista government of Nicaragua.
Former CIA Division Chief Melvin Goodman.
The Iran-Contra scandal was huge and should have been much bigger. What the United States decided to do was to open up ties to Tehran by selling them surface-to-air missiles. The profits of those sales were then put into banks in Switzerland and were removed to pass to the Contras, who were trying to overthrow the Sandinistas. What Iran-Contra represented at the very heart of the problem was to ignore American law. American law clearly stated that the United States was not allowed to provide military assistance to the Contras. And American law also stated that we weren't going to do business with governments such as Iran that were involved with terrorist actions. The instability that we have contributed to creates the kind of chaos and disarray that leads to more immigration. Because you can argue that if we move into these societies and contribute to this dysfunction, we have a moral obligation to help the people who feel unsafe in the situations that we, in part, have created.
Grammy Award-winning singer and composer Luis Enrique.
There's a Luis Enrique Mejia Lopez from 1 year old to 15. There's another Luis Enrique Mejia Lopez from 15 on. Everything changed. Everything in what a 15-year-old supposedly should not be exposed to. But in my case, it gave me the tools to be who I am now. I lived in a city called Diriamba. And right next to the house that I lived in, there was the police station. A couple of nights, my brother and I heard people screaming so loud that you could hear it in our rooms. For me, that was a very traumatic experience.
El mundo no es lo que veía. desde la ventana de mi cuarto. El verano del 78, vi una nube que crecía y mi infancia que se iba.
On one side, I had some of my family that were with the government, and some of my family that was not with the government. So I was caught up in the middle of this thing, trying to figure out things for myself. You can't make a kid when he's 15 years old choose a side, especially of something that he doesn't truly know what it is about. I lost a lot of my friends. And then you ask yourself, what are we dying for? What saved my brother and I is that my grandfather, on my mom's side of the family, decided to send us to the States. I didn't even have a clue that we were coming into this country illegally. When I started high school, that's when I found out what being illegal meant.
You know what's interesting? That myth continues.
I had the possibility to apply for a scholarship to go to Berkeley. I wanted to go to Berkeley and study music and learn. And I couldn't do it.
Crecí en las sombras del silencio. Fui un ilegal con miedo. Sin papeles y sin dirección. Desde los 15 años soy el extranjero. No soy de aquí ni soy de allá.
I had done some music that spoke very strongly about how I felt with the Sandinista government in my country. That helped me to get political asylum. I had all the tools I needed to make something happen for my life.
Hoy tengo un hijo y no quisiera verlo pasar esa experiencia. Si un día no hubiera fronteras, creo que mi historia no se repitiera.
But once you understand that our government had a role in creating the crisis that brought these people here, then you may have a different attitude as to how we should respond to these refugees from that violence.
The Sandinista-Contra conflict resulted in 50,000 deaths and $12 billion in national debt. In 1986, the International Court of Justice found that the U.S. violated international law by funding the Contras and mining Nicaragua's harbors. The U.S. Congress extended legal residency to thousands of Nicaraguan refugees in 1997. More than 500,000 Nicaraguans now live in the United States. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the US, Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. We now return to more excerpts from Harvest of Empire, a documentary film narrated by Juan Gonzalez. Listeners, please be advised. The following segment includes language that may be offensive to some and a graphic description of rape.
I had never seen anything like El Salvador. I was more frightened there than Vietnam.
Father Roy Bourgeois is founder of School of the Americas Watch.
I've never seen such brutality of a military toward their people. The death squads were running wild. What was going on there was the slaughter of the innocents. Anyone against U.S. foreign policy or talking about land reform, they were labeled subversive, el enemigo, the enemy.
Maria Guardado is a Salvadoran immigrant and torture survivor.
Me ataron las manos hacia atrás y me pusieron una venda muy fuerte.
They tied my hands behind my back and blindfolded me tightly. I could hear people screaming, young and old, men and women crying, screaming in agony.
Y que daban gritos horribles. Me dijeron, no te vamos a hacer nada. Lo que queremos es que nos des los nombres y direcciones de tus compañeros con quien trabajas.
They told me, we are not going to do anything to you. We want you to give us the names and addresses of the people you work with. I kept telling them, I don't know anyone. I don't have names or addresses. They said, this bitch doesn't want to talk. Someone said, who gets the first torture? One of them said, me.
Yo de momento pensé que era así como algo psicológico, pero no, luego me quitaron la ropa.
For a moment, I thought it was something psychological, but no, they took off my clothes. One of them raped me. They put electrical shocks on my breasts and all over my body.
Luego dijeron, no, esta cabrona como no quieres hablar y todo, pásenme la estaca, solo me dieron vuelta.
After that, they said, this bitch still doesn't want to talk. Pass me the stake. They turned me over and forced the stake into my rectum.
Que me morí de repente.
I felt like I had died.
Luego sentí que oí que dijeron, esta cabrona ya se murió.
Then I heard them say, this bitch is dead.
En las afueritas de San Miguel, ahí me tiraron a un lado de la carretera.
Outside of San Miguel, they threw me on the side of the road. I didn't know how long I was out.
Sí existen los milagros.
Miracles really do exist, because there were thousands and thousands of torture victims who were not lucky enough to survive.
We can talk for hours about Bishop Romero. He was special. He, like most of us, went through this conversion. He was silent, aloof. But something happened to Bishop Romero. He began to hear the cry of his people. He felt their suffering. And what he said was that, you know, I'm a bishop, a Catholic bishop with a lot of influence and power. I must speak for my people. You don't have a voice.
Every Sunday, the whole country listened to him. You could walk down the block and not miss a word he said because everybody was listening. And he would say, Guardia, basta ya. It's enough already. Stop it. Stop the killing.
The last sermon of Archbishop Oscar Romero that he gave in the cathedral the day before he was assassinated, where he made a special plea to the men in the military, saying to them, stop the killing. Lay down your weapons. Disobey your superior officers telling you to kill your fellow campesinos. And obey a higher law, that law that says, thou shalt not kill.
Cuyos lamentos suben hasta el cielo cada día más.
His assassination in church stunned the entire nation.
As the crowd started to grow, they realized that this was going to be a very difficult time. And we could see all the Guardia that were on all the roofs. All of a sudden, there was a shot fired. And then the bomb went off. everybody just scattered. Then the Guardia opened fire.
Sister Pat Murray.
It's important that the world know that we stood behind him.
Ambassador Robert White.
For the first time, someone had faced down the Salvadoran military and said, you people are killing the people you are sworn to protect.
Father Paul Schindler had received a telephone call saying his firemen had seen the bodies of four women.
Sister Terry Alexander, Mary Knoll missionary.
Very definitely American. He began reading the description of the four women. And as he read each one, I could say, that was Jean, that's Jean. That's Dorothy. That's Ita. Three of us knelt down there to pray. And I guess my prayer was, like Maura had said once before, how long, oh God, how long must this continue to happen?
Stop the repression!
Look at this guy. Look at this fella. What's your position?
Stop the repression in El Salvador! Our tax dollars are killing priests!
Let me just say a word about El Salvador. Maybe it'll help.
Why are we killing priests in El Salvador?
The answer is we're not. Now you be quiet, and here's the answer to your question.
You will understand if you read from our reporting that it was the Salvadoran military who killed these women. I have no doubt about that.
We learned that the vast majority of those who participated in these massacres and human rights abuses were trained right down the street here at the School of the Americas. The United Nations Truth Commission report on El Salvador documented that those who killed Bishop Oscar Romero trained here at this school. Those who raped and killed the churchwomen of the five responsible, four of them graduates. There was El Mesote, where over 800 were killed, over 100 children. Of the 12 responsible, 10 of them graduates of the School of the Americas. Few people knew about this. It was hiding behind this wall of secrecy. Many at this school became their country's dictators.
Actually, some of the worst tyrants in South American and Central American history have come through the School of Americas. And it's essentially an indoctrination tool. It's a tool for building close ties between the people we identify as future military leaders in Central America and South America and American military representatives.
When you finance and train a gang of uniformed butchers, and they begin wholesale killing, wiping out whole villages, the people don't emigrate, they flee.
El Salvador is a perfect example of how U.S. policy in Latin America affects migration. In 1980, there were only 94,000 Salvadorans in the United States. As the war escalated, tens of thousands of Salvadorans fled and came to this country. And today, the Salvadoran population of the United States is poised to become the third largest of all the Latino groups in the country.
It's not just what happens to the Latino community and to the Latino individuals and these families that are being ripped apart. It's what does it say about us as an American society?
Journalist Maria Hinojosa.
What does it say about us as a society that we have institutions that will go and separate families, American-born children from their parents, in a society that says that we're about family values? What does it say about a so-called free society that you can get a knock on the door, and if it's tied to immigration, they do not need a warrant to come into your home? There is no such thing as an illegal human being, as an illegal immigrant, as an illegal alien. To call people illegal is the beginning of dehumanizing.
Nobody likes to leave their home. No one relishes the idea of abandoning their family or their children or their loved ones for years at a time. They only do it out of desperation. They only do it because they can no longer live in the conditions that they're facing in their own country. The harvest of the empire is that all the peoples of the former colonial nations are coming to the metropolis. They're coming to the very countries that used to dominate them. The reality is that those advanced countries need their labor, because all the countries that fought in World War II and produced huge baby boomer generations are now growing old, and they're going to need somebody to work in their countries to maintain that baby boomer population. And those workers will inevitably come from Asia, Africa, and Latin America.
I believe that people, in fact, are born with something called the American spirit. And you may be born with that American spirit, whether you're born in Mexico or in Peru or in Thailand or wherever. And it's this vision, this idea that if you really work hard enough, there's a country out there where there's a level playing field and you can make it. And that's what I think motivates people, this American spirit that they're born with. And that's why what I tell my children is that they have a responsibility to speak up. They have to speak up for what it really is to be an American, what it really is to be an immigrant in this country, what it really is to be a Latino. It's gotta be our young people who understand that they can't be silent. It's on their shoulders.
All nations invest in their young people. And that investment never gets paid back until the young people finish school and become productive members of the society. So whether it is an immigrant child or an American child, the investment is in the future. America has always been a nation in the process of becoming, in process of change. That's one of the hallmarks of American history, the constant change of the population. It is an immigrant nation.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. You've been listening to excerpts from Harvest of Empire, a film written and narrated by Juan Gonzalez. For a CD copy of this program, check out our website, radioproject.org. That's also where you can get podcasts, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.